Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the recent emergence of racist remarks from the Romney campaign and assess the legacy of the GOP's Southern strategy and whether the overt and irrational hatred of President Obama, often expressed by Tea Party Republicans, is becoming more or less acceptable. Colin Powell's former Chief of Staff, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, joins us to discuss Republican criticism of Colin Powell's endorsement of President Obama that suggested Powell's choice was based on race, not the reasons he enunciated. Then, following a recent poll by the Associated Press that indicated racial attitudes have not improved since America elected its first black president, we'll continue to look into race as a factor in this election. Andra Gillespie, a professor of political science at Emory University, joins us to discuss how many Americans are hardwired with racial resentment that politicians can exploit in a highly polarized society undergoing economic distress. Then finally, we'll examine the fallout from the New York Times investigation of the wealth accrued by the family of China's outgoing leader, Wen Jiabao. China expert Perry Link joins us. He has been following the behind-the-scenes succession struggle going on within the Chinese Communist Party Politburo that indicates the normally bland leadership transition is deadlocked in intra-party wrangling over power, privilege, and profit. Joining us now is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, Colonel Wilkerson went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And your remarks on MSNBC the other night certainly got a lot of attention, certainly got my attention. Of course, these remarks in response to the endorsement for a second term of President Barack Obama by former Secretary of State Colin Powell. John Sununu is not the only person who was critical. John McCain insisted that by giving this endorsement, Colin Powell was harming his legacy. Who do you think is listening to this? Is this dog whistle politics, or is this an indication of America's fall from grace in terms of polity?
Ian, I think it was George Orwell who wrote that in a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. I've gotten a lot of emails over my time speaking about the things that I have spoken about since I left the Bush administration in January of 2005, but I have been overwhelmed in the last 20 hours. I've never seen such a volume of emails. 90% of them are running basically positive. The 10% that aren't come mostly from Republicans, and I'm very sad to say, probably demonstrate graphically that what I said was accurate. This is something that both academically, as you pointed out in your introductory remarks, we all know about the bargain with the devil that Nixon made to attract Dixiecrats away from the Democratic Party and to the Republican Party during times when Dixiecrats were angry over desegregation, anger over busing, and so forth and so on. But this really even has stunned me in terms of what I uncovered, apparently, though there's no way to check party affiliation on these emails, but from the narratives, what I've uncovered in the Republican Party in terms of the angst and the vehemence with which I'm being denounced. I'm being told I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan. I'm being told that I don't understand what Democrats have done to African Americans by welfare programs. You name it, I'm being accused of it, and usually in less than gentlemanly language.
Well, specifically what you said on MSNBC the other night on Ed get your cell phones out, Schulz's program. Just quoting you, my party, unfortunately, is the bastion of those people, not all of them, but most of them, who are still basing their positions on race. Let me just be candid. My party is full of racists, and the real reason a considerable portion of my party wants President Obama out of the White House has nothing to do with the content of his character, nothing to do with his competence as commander-in-chief and president, and everything to do with the color of his skin, and that's despicable. So,
I stand by those remarks.
Well, I think they resonate with an awful lot of people. I mean, I guess the question is, do they resonate with the majority or the minority? Are we in a post-racial society or not? I mean,
That's a very interesting question, particularly since I think many of these people, Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, stand at the peak of these people who are hiding what is their true problem with their republic right now, and that is that they know conclusively, all you have to do is look at the demographics, that they will be in the minority very shortly. In fact, if you combine Asians, blacks, and Hispanics and other than Caucasians, lily whites, right now they're in the minority. And this scares the bejesus out of them. And if it's Hispanics and blacks becoming brown, in other words, we could say in color terms, becoming the majority in this country, they're absolutely apoplectic about that because they think it's the end of the republic.
So what is happening, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, again, retired U.S. Army Colonel, former Chief of Staff to the United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. The Sununu, John Sununu, is a principal surrogate for Mitt Romney. So the real question, I think, is the extent to which they coordinate their remarks. It's hardly seemed an accident that this would come out. You know, in elections, one misstep can cost a candidate the entire ball game, and they are very, very careful, and they're careful about what they say. And when they say things that usually are inflammatory, it's deliberate. Quite often the remarks are designed to elicit publicity. So two questions here about Sununu. Do you think it was an off-the-cuff mistake on his part, or two, was it deliberate and therefore coordinated presumably with the campaign?
Initially, I thought it was a sacrifice bunt, Ian, for the very reasons you just described. Powell had endorsed. They needed to deflate that, so they drug out John Sununu, who would have been the last person I would have drug out because John has a way of letting his rear end overload his mouth. But they drug him out to hit a sacrifice bunt. And that's all I thought it was, especially as he came back and tried to more or less explain his remarks. But then I started hearing other remarks he had made over time and at that time. And once I heard those remarks, I realized that it was probably more than just him hitting a sacrifice bunt. Indeed, he was expressing, however ambiguously or inchoately, some of the feelings that I'm now describing to the American people that exist inside the Republican Party. As I said, they exist across the country. We have not done away with racism and intolerance and bigotry and hatred in this country. To that end, part of the angst within my party is also about President Obama's stand on gays and lesbians. They abominate that stance. Their posture towards that stance reminds me of the posture, some of which still exists, but in its original days was really bloody, against abortion and against Roe v. Wade. These two things combined, gays, abortion, or three things actually, gays and recognizing them, abortion and racism, make a very powerful and potent poison within the ranks of all of us, but certainly within the ranks of the political party that I'm a member of.
So when you mentioned, Colonel Wilkerson, that you looked into earlier remarks of John Sununu's that are consistent with what he said the other day about Colin Powell essentially endorsing President Obama because they both are black, as opposed to the reasons that Powell enunciated. And in fact, I'd like to go into those reasons because I think that's what's being missed in this whole thing. And perhaps that's the whole point. So the people don't actually listen to what Powell said. They get sort of.
No, you're right. You're right. I think that's their political maneuver, is to deflate and de-energize, if you will, what he said, what his endorsement meant.
So the remarks that come to mind that recently after the first debate, John Sununu called the president lazy in his lackluster performance against Romney. And he also earlier in July said...
Where in our history, if you know anything about the 400-year history, and it is 400 years, it goes back well into colonial times, where have you heard that term used before?
Right.
It fell off the lips of every racist in America. That is the 150-year, at least, characterization of blacks in America, quote, lazy, unquote.
And, of course, it's hard to believe that could be, talk about an irony. I mean, this is the legacy of slavery. The African Americans are the ones that actually did the work, wasn't it? I mean,
Isn't that ironic?
Right.
We even have a new history coming out, prefaced in Smithsonian Magazine, this latest issue, looking at one of my heroes, looking at a person who is very, very dear to the College of William and Mary, Thomas Jefferson. And we find in this new revisionist history, and it's indisputable that the archives have been consulted correctly, that he, later in his life, when he realized the interest-bearing rate of black slavery, that is to say that it was a win-win all around. You not only made money off their labor on the plantation, you also made money off their procreation and selling them. And so it was a completely, completely profit-filled operation. And Jefferson's the one that formulated the mathematics behind expressing this free interest rate economic system, which many have said, and I agree with them looking at the facts, that next to northern manufacturing, southern slavery was the second most important element in building the powerful economy that the United States eventually became. So we built this country on the backs of northern manufacturing and southern slavery.
And
lazy?
Exactly. I mean, it's interesting, actually, one of the founding fathers, in fact, he refused to sign the Declaration of Independence, George Mason, who was in many ways the intellectual mentor of both Jefferson and George Washington. He had the biggest library in the New World and was very, very well-read man. He refused to sign the Declaration of Independence because he believed that they were trying to finesse around slavery and that it would come back to bite them. And he essentially predicted the Civil War.
He was absolutely right. It came back to bite them in the form of 600,000 dead Americans and over 1 million casualties.
So the other remark, of course, from Sununu was that back in July, I wish the president would learn to be an American. And that goes back, of course, to Sarah Palin in the 2008 election. It's a tiresome and divisive tactic to split Americans between real and, presumably, unreal Americans.
Well, here, though, Ian, is the essence of the intellectual, not the intolerance, not the bigotry, not the prejudice. This is the core of the intellectual argument. My party has leaders within it and a rank and file following those leaders that thinks that America was created by wealthy people and that the only way we can meet the future, indeed meet the present, is to have wealthy people who amass zillions of dollars and then somehow pennies from those dollars trickle down to the rest of us. That's their economic interpretation, and when they see a person who doesn't necessarily believe the way they do, like President Obama, or for that matter, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, pick almost anyone in the 20th century who wore the Democratic garb, they're scared to death of them, because what they're really mounting in is a defense of their wealth. They're not mounting a defense of the republic, a defense of the country, a defense of values or our way of life. They're mounting a defense of their wealth, which increasingly looks a lot to those of us who deal in these sorts of things every day in the academic world to be an oligarchy and not a republic.
Well, I suppose in a way it's the country started out as a democracy, the rule of those with property, and that was modified, and democracy is something that's been fought for and evolved over the centuries. But we've had these oligarchical periods, and it's interesting to note that your party, the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, is effectively run by Karl Rove, whose mentor, as he is himself has expressed on a number of occasions, is Mark Hanna, the man behind the scenes that brought about the McKinley election during the first Gilded Age.
And then had the awful shock of an assassin's bullet that put their worst nightmare in the White House. They thought they'd sidelined him as vice president and they'd never have to deal with him again. He was in a job that, as John Garner said, was not worth warm spit. And then all of a sudden, an assassin's bullet took out McKinley, and we had Theodore Roosevelt, and he began to wage war on the robber barons and the predatory capitalists.
So when you
would that we had such an occasion today in the Republican Party.
Well, it does seem, Colonel Wilkerson, that not only are we entering a period where our very democracy is in question, and whether or not it's become an oligarchy in our economy, whether or not it's become a plutonomy, and that our politics have been captured by money and by those with money. One of the things that I find that's emerging now is to add to this dystopian picture, albeit an accurate one, is this new feudalism where you have the people like the Koch brothers who own Dixie Cups and all these companies like Georgia Pacific, who are sending out missives to their employees, essentially intimidating and blackmailing them into voting for Romney, suggesting if they don't vote for Romney, they will lose their jobs. And one of them, the CEO of Rightheight, Mark White, has said that the employers might suffer personal consequences if they vote for Obama. I find that kind of feudal.
It is feudal. And again, it's part of this wealth defense. It's the way predatory capitalists marshal their forces around what power they do have. And, of course, the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, enhanced that power majorly, in my view. To argue, as my Republican colleagues do, that it just balanced corporate power with union power is risible. It makes me want to laugh. Union power is dwindling so badly in this country that one looks around for any vestige of it remaining. So this has created a situation where people like the Koch brothers, both through that decision by the Supreme Court and methods that you just described, are running this country. And there's another fright out there right now, and that's the fact that we have states who are going to participate in this national election that have no way to conduct a recount. No way whatsoever. Because they've so committed, for financial reasons, their political process, their election process, their ballot counting process, to computer data processing systems, that there is no way whatsoever to have a recount. And we're going to have some close votes. And we're going to have some computer hacking, I would predict. And we're going to have some things like we had in 2004 in Ohio, where I'm quite confident, I can't prove it, I wish I could, that George W. Bush's people, led by Karl Rove, did some hanky-panky in Ohio with the computer data processing systems. We've got a real problem in this country. It's pitiful that we should be the ones begging the world to send election observers to our elections, because our elections have the potential to be as corrupt as anybody's in the world.
And of course, when they get to within 1 or 2%, that's when trickery, a la Karl Rove, can be employed.
Yes.
I mean, of course, the irony is Kerry has the real results come out, and I think there's a lot of evidence that that the election was stolen by both Karl Rove and Secretary of State of Ohio Kenneth Blackwell. Had the Kerry won fair and square, as he apparently did, it would have been a difficult for him to become president under the Electoral College with a deficit of 2.4 million in the popular vote. There's some suspicion or some expectation that we may even get down to a division, even a 50-50 split in the Electoral College.
I could see it, and I could see that 50-50, at least 2 or 3 percentage points of its coming into being done by people playing around with the election process.
So the answer to that would, I suppose, be that the Democrats had better wake up and come out in droves to overcome that percentage.
I said to someone the other day, I said, as has happened so many times in our history over the past, let's just hope the corruption on the one side counterbalances the corruption on the other side. Otherwise, we're not going to have a fair election.
Well, just in closing, Colonel Wilkerson, let's return to Colin Powell's endorsement of President Obama for a second term and what he really said, which, of course, was obfuscated by a deliberate, it looks like a deliberate injection of racism in the remarks of John Sununu that perhaps distracted a lot of people from the very important point that Powell was making, which, by the way, the president himself did not make in his debate with the third and final debate on foreign policy with Romney. He pulled back from saying what I think he should have said, which is that Romney's campaign, Romney, of course, was trying to suggest he had the same foreign policy as Obama. But if Obama had mentioned who's advising Romney in terms of his foreign policy, he could have much more effectively tied Romney's foreign policy to George W. Bush. So it took Colin Powell to do that.
Well, this is my principal concern, and I won't speak for Powell. He spoke well enough for himself, but I know these people. I've seen them work, and I am looking at the same sheet of music being developed and sung from right now that I looked at in 2002 and 2003, to my eternal shame, and I don't like what I'm seeing. I'm seeing the same people marching us down an inevitable war in Western Asia, this time with Iran, that I saw do it with Iraq in 2002 and 3. And this is very disturbing. I think a war with Iran, as Secretary Gates said in Norfolk the other day, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, would be catastrophic.
And this is the neoconservatives who dominate Romney's foreign policy advisors.
Some of the same people that dominated George W. Bush. And we're looking at a first term for Mitt Romney being one of, we have to face it, an inexperienced individual in the Oval Office. And that's the same thing we have with George W. Bush. I would argue his second term was somewhat better than his first. In his first term, he was influenced to a maximum degree by these neoconservatives, led by Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. We don't need another president learning the ropes in this most dangerous time with these people hanging on to those ropes. I think that's the principal reason that I'm going to pull the lever for President Obama on November the 6th.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, Colonel Wilkerson went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about racism in this election.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
All beneath the empty smiles, most cats in my area be loving the hysteria. Synthesized surface conceals the interior. America, land of opportunity, mirages and camouflages, more than usually. Speaking loudly, saying nothing, you confusing me, you losing me. Your game is twisted, want me enlisted, and your usury. Foolishly, most men join the ranks cluelessly, but foolishly accept the deception, believe the perception. Reflection rarely seen across the surface of the looking glass, walking the street, wondering who they be looking past, looking gas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andre Gillespie, who is a professor of political science at Emory University. Before joining the faculty at Emory, she worked as an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman, and her current research focuses on the political leadership of the post-civil rights generation. She's the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. She just was recently a Martin Luther King visiting scholar in the political science department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andre Gillespie.
Thank you very much. I should note that I'm back at Emory. I'm not at MIT anymore.
Oh, you aren't?
Yeah.
Okay. So the AP just did a poll on racial attitudes in the United States, and they found that they have not improved in the 4 years since the United States elected its first black president. In all, 51% of Americans now express explicit anti-black attitudes, compared with 48% in a similar 2008 survey. So how do you think this is going to impact the re-election of President Obama? Indeed, of course, that's assuming he does get re-elected.
Well, it will make it a little bit more difficult for President Obama to be elected. It won't make it impossible, but that means that there were some voters who may have been a little bit more inclined to support him who now have tapped into some conscious and subconscious racism, and that might actually prevent them from being able to cast a vote for President Obama.
Well, the assumption always is that in times of economic distress, people's darker side, if you will, come out, perhaps out of anxiety and confusion, and they're much more subject to demagoguery. When the president was elected, obviously President Bush had pretty much tanked, the economy had tanked, and the wars that he got us into were deeply unpopular. And then subsequent to the president's election, then the economy really tanked, and he's having a hard time pulling us out of it. So the conditions back then were much different today. I mean, there was, you know, I mean, arguably the president's election could be considered in some parts a repudiation of Bush rather than an embrace of Obama.
I think that that's somewhat accurate. In 2008, polling that was done that assessed during the Democratic primary which of the Democratic candidates was the better leader and which candidate was the better change agent, what we saw was that there was a difference between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton was viewed as the stronger leader, but Barack Obama was viewed as the greater change agent. And when voters were asked what they were looking for in a candidate, they wanted change more than they wanted strong leadership. Historically, if we go back and we look at what people thought of Jesse Jackson when he ran for the Democratic nomination for president in 1988, for example, people rated him lower than his white counterparts on leadership. And so this seems to be an Achilles heel for African-American candidates. Obama overcame it because of the perfect storm of conditions in 2008, so not just the unpopular wars and the unpopular incumbent president from the opposite party, but then also the financial crisis and John McCain's somewhat bizarre response to the financial crisis. And so in the 4 years since, when people didn't see the dramatic, miraculous turnaround that they expected, people soured on Obama's leadership. And so some of those latent prejudices kind of came to the forefront. I think it's important to point out that with that survey, that they not only asked people explicit questions about their racial attitudes, but they also did subconscious tests. And so they found that implicit biases still do persist in American society and that those have an impact on how people perceive politics and on their vote choice.
So, Andre Gillespie, do these, you know, racist attitudes that people harbor that may be beneath the surface, does economic distress bring them out or does political demagoguery bring them out?
So political demagoguery, we know for sure, does. So, and it's, we've known this for the last 20, 40 years. We can go back and observe this over history with the Southern Strategy, for instance, or even the types of visual images that have been used against candidates, particularly candidates of color when they run for office. Sometimes you don't have to say something that's explicitly racist because everybody knows that that's not acceptable anymore. All you have to do many times is show them a picture or invoke a code word in order to tap into that type of biased racial resentment against particular candidates of color. And so Black and Latino candidates in particular have to be very, very mindful, and their response has to be very explicit. And so people like Barack Obama don't like to talk about race because they want to appear to be inclusive and they want to counter the stereotype that Black politicians only serve Black interests or Latino politicians only serve Latino interests. But when you are the victim of these subtle racial attacks, you or your surrogates need to be very explicit in pointing out that that's racist because people know that they're not supposed to be racist anymore, and that can help neutralize some of that demagoguery.
Again, I'm speaking with Andre Gillespie, who's a professor of political science at Emory University and the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. So obviously then the dog whistle remarks by John Sununu, a campaign surrogate for Mitt Romney, in response to the news that Colin Powell had endorsed for a second time Barack Obama for president. He, of course, and we've been discussing this with Colonel Wilkerson, Colin Powell's former chief of staff, that he essentially gave, well, is this what happened? Did he give these Americans that hold these latent racist views, did he give them permission to feel that way by suggesting that the only reason that Colin Powell supports Obama is because they're both Black?
Yes, he did, but I should note that he wasn't the first. It wasn't the first time that he's done this, and it won't be the last in the next 9 days over the course of this particular cycle. So I actually probably would have preferred a much more stronger response on behalf of Obama and his surrogates to say that this was racist. I think a lot of people in the media kind of caught on to that. And what they're doing is they're tapping into a certain type of stereotype that, one, Blacks, because they're so uniformly Democratic in their voting behavior, are monolithic and they all think alike, and that people vote, or that African Americans in particular, vote for other Blacks because of race, as though other groups don't have an affinity towards people who have very similar backgrounds to them. And so, one, that needs to be pointed out. It probably needs to be pointed out a little more strongly than it has over the last couple of weeks, but given the fact that John Sununu has backed away from those comments and has now acknowledged that Colin Powell has substantive reasons to support President Obama and that race doesn't have to be the primary motivator for his decision to endorse him, I think is really, really important, and it speaks volumes. But I think most people have already made their decision about this race, and if people were hardwired to oppose President Obama on account of race, they were already comfortable doing that.
Well, but John Sununu's apology was less than sincere, shall we say, because he essentially changed the context for the remarks. He just made up a new context.
I mean, it's not my place to sit and judge a person's sincerity at all. It's just a question that I can say that it happened. It's a question that it looked racist and that it sounded racist, and the fact that he had to backtrack actually gives further credence to the fact that that was racially tinged and that there were racial overtones to it. That's significant enough. I mean, I can't be a person's priest or a shrink and get into people's heads. I can just go by what people have said. And so just sort of the train of events suggests that everybody acknowledges now that that was had racial overtones to it.
Right, but there's an expression, Andre Gillespie, that a lie goes around the world once before the truth has time to put its pants on.
I would agree. But given the fact that this race is very polarized and that there are very, very few undecided voters, that long-term impact of this over the course of the campaign is probably minimal. John Sununu had already made other comments that people thought were stereotypical, so it's not that people are discounting it. It's just that the people who are paying attention to those comments are the folks who've already made up their minds, not necessarily those who are undecided. Could it have an impact on undecided voters? Absolutely, but there are just so few of them at this point in the race that it would be really hard to tell what the long-term impact of it would be.
So I'm sure, Andrew Gillespie, if the president is to lose this race, historians will point to the first debate and his lackluster performance there. And there's a certain mystery still surrounding what happened to the president. One of the interpretations that I'd heard is that he didn't take on Mitt Romney, who had appeared to have reversed himself almost entirely on all of the positions he'd taken over the last 2 years and suddenly was an overnight moderate. And the president did challenge him in a very polite way about this inconsistency. However, the theory that one hears is that one thing that restrains the president from getting tough is the fear of appearing to be an angry black man. Is that something that you think is festering under the surface?
Oh, absolutely. And especially in the media coverage of the preparation for the first debate, the Romney campaign suggested that they wanted to try to get President Obama to kind of lose his temper a little bit and look aggressive. And so knowing that that was the strategy going into that debate, President Obama overcompensated and therefore underperformed in that first debate. And so he really does have to contend with stereotypes that black men deal with in the workplace, you know, in every sector of our economy. And so it's interesting to see that it doesn't matter how high one gets, still race is salient enough that even the president of the United States has to be careful about stereotypical images that relate to his race and his gender group.
And this Associated Press poll that just came out that indicates racial attitudes have not improved in the 4 years since the United States elected its first black president. Is there an overall sense of where America stands in terms of this historic change from the kind of atavistic Ozzie and Harriet world that Ronald Reagan harkened back to when he was president, a world in which, going back to the American dream, the black and white version of it from Ozzie and Harriet, where blacks and Hispanics were largely invisible. I spoke with Joan Walsh on Thursday. She's got a book about what's the matter with white men, or white people, I should say. And there is this question about holding on to a past that really never was as halcyon as people imagine it was, and this new emerging majority in the United States. How do you see that historic change? Because to my mind, if the president does win, it might well be that watershed where the minority majority become the majority.
Well, demographic changes suggest that, you know, in the next 30 to 40 years, the U.S. will not be majority white anymore. Whites will still be a plurality, but minorities collectively will make up more than 50% of the population. And so as a country, we're going to have to figure out what that looks like, in terms of the distribution of power and economic resources and other types of things. I am very much influenced by my old teacher, Roger Smith, who co-wrote a book with Philip Klinkner called The Unsteady March. And one of the things that they really wanted to hone in on in their examination of sort of civil rights history and politics in the United States is that we usually think about progress as being linear and always being progressive, but we always need to think about this being progressive and regressive. So you take a step forward, you take a step back, you take two steps forward, you take one step back. So we shouldn't have been surprised that there is the potential for a backlash to the Obama presidency. And so we've seen that with the rise of the Tea Party, and Tea Party sympathizers are disproportionately more racially resentful than people in the general population. Sort of the vehement sort of opposition to the president's agenda, even the narrowness of this particular election, suggests that President Obama may underperform relative to a white Democratic incumbent in previous years under the same types of conditions. These kinds of things suggest that race is still very salient and that we're all still trying to figure this out. And so while we're not at the 1960s, and so we're not going to go back to Ozzie and Harriet, we're not going to go back to 1960 by any stretch of the imagination, we should have expected a kind of retrenchment from the euphoria of November 4th, 2008. And I think the thing that's probably been most interesting for this is that we haven't had many examples, you know, at high executive political positions in the United States. So we've had President Obama, and we've had a couple of black governors who have been elected. the post-Reconstruction. So we usually look at black mayors. And so we knew in cities that when black mayors ran for re-election that they usually got a higher percentage of the white vote than they did when they first ran for election, and that whites who had served under African-American mayors or had lived under African-American mayors had different views about African-American leadership and competence in this particular area. Well, we don't see that happening at the national level, and part of that is that it's an apples-to-orange comparison. But there are other things now that I'm thinking about. So, for instance, you know, we usually think about in the 60s and 70s, and this is where the study that was done by Zoltan Heinol at the University of California at San Diego sort of plays out. You know, it doesn't, and you can't take into account the number of whites who leave cities when blacks become mayor, especially 30 and 40 years ago. This is not an option for most people to kind of expatriate themselves. So we have to kind of deal with the hand that we're dealt, and so people are uncomfortable with this. But this doesn't mean that 10 or 20 years from now that President Obama's legacy will be that it does actually push the needle forward. It's just going to be jagged progress as opposed to the nice, smooth, linear progress that I think in our own heads we kind of created this really rosy narrative that was really naive.
So you mentioned Andrew Gillespie, you mentioned the euphoria of 2008 when President Obama was elected, and I suppose to some extent it was a feel-good moment for a lot of people, particularly white folks who had never voted for a black president before. Has that dissipated? Do you think that was a one-time fluke?
Oh, clearly that level of euphoria was definitely one time. Could it happen again? No, I mean, people are usually beguiled by charismatic leadership, so I'm sure that there is somebody who is going to be able to engender that type of excitement at some point in the future. Hopefully we learn to not place messianic expectations on our presidents anymore. They're humans, so they're fallible. Also, they're constrained in terms of the structure of the office. There are things presidents can't do, and our federal government with its system of checks and balances and a system of separation of powers is designed for slow incremental change. So you can't expect a president or you can't expect Congress or you can't expect the Supreme Court to be able to push widespread change. Do we have these moments where there are, you know, clear moments of clear direct change? Yeah, but overall, this process is going to be slow. It's going to be highly contested, and it's designed to be that way so that we don't have these radical shifts every few years, depending on who's in office or who isn't in office.
Well, just in closing, Andrew Gillespie, you're in Atlanta, Georgia, and, of course, the famous Southern Strategy under Richard Nixon was propelled by Lyndon Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act in 1965. Johnson remarked or lamented at the time that the Democrats would lose the South and lose the Dixiecrats. But in many ways, that could be argued as a healthy change. How would you assess the state of the Southern Strategy? And of course, it's worth noting that there was also a Northern Strategy, in a sense, of splitting the white working vote, eliciting the so-called Reagan Democrats or peeling them off. And, of course, the anti-war protests in the Vietnam days did polarize that. And the blue-collar union folks, remember, they beat up the students, anti-war students. So, and Labor did not support McGovern, who just died recently. So I'm painting a broad historical brush here, but I'd like to get your final comment on it.
Well, I mean, there are parts of the Southern Strategy that are still in play today. So the Southern Strategy introduced the use of the code word to us. So earlier, segregationists in the South, and they were Democrats at the time, and many of them switched partisan allegiances later on, could openly talk about the biological inferiority of blacks, could support segregation, could use racial slurs, and it was considered perfectly acceptable. The Southern Strategy came about because it was no longer socially acceptable to be explicitly racist. So, you know, Nixon talks about law and order. He talks about freedom of choice in terms of school integration. And these kinds of things have taken on a life of their own today. So while the Republican Party has officially apologized for the use of the Southern Strategy, anytime you hear somebody like John Sununu say that President Obama was lazy in his first debate performance, people are going to read racial overtones and undertones into that to point out where he may be priming racial resentment or priming a stereotype to get people to judge the president accordingly. When people talk about welfare, when Newt Gingrich invokes the food stamp presidency to talk about the Obama administration, knowing that most Americans overestimate the number of blacks who are on public assistance, and that we tie poverty and blackness into a larger degree, into a growing degree, Latino-ness in the United States, like, that's racial. When people show black criminals on television and invokes them in ads to talk about rapists, and, you know, it's not just Willie Horton. This was used against Deval Patrick when he ran for governor of Massachusetts in 2006. Like, these kinds of things are the legacy of the Southern strategy. So in many ways, the Southern strategy never went away. It's just that certain people who perpetrated it originally or who are standing in for them have now apologized for them, but that doesn't stop people from, you know, subtly invoking race to be able to make a point and to tap into subconscious races. So I think the Southern strategy is very much still a part of this larger discussion that we've been having.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Andra Gillespie.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Andra Gillespie, who's professor of political science at Emory University. Before joining the faculty at Emory, she worked as an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman, and her current research focuses on the political leadership of the post-civil rights generation, and she's the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. She just was recently a Martin Luther King visiting scholar in the political science department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how come the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabai's family have accrued wealth worth $2.7 billion. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Perry Link, who holds a Chancellorial Chair for Innovative Teaching across disciplines and is also a Professor of Comparative Literature and Foreign Languages at the University of California, Riverside. One of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people, he has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. And in 1990, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform students' protests in June of 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. Welcome to Background Briefing, Perry Link.
My pleasure to be here, Ian.
And Perry, how come the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabai's family have been able to accrue assets worth at least $2.7 billion, which the New York Times just recently did an exhaustive investigative report uncovering the corporate DNA of the various members of the family. So, I mean, should we be surprised?
No, we shouldn't be surprised. And the first thing to point out is that this family is not the only one. Just a few months ago, Bloomberg News revealed a similar pattern in the family of Xi Jinping, the man who's about to take over. And a couple of months before that, the Financial Times had an even broader account of many of the top leaders in this pattern. It's long been rumored on the Chinese internet, in the Chinese public, that this kind of thing goes on. And what this David Barbosa has done is to meticulously, and I understand he worked on it for more than a year, gathering data to make this extremely impressive, you know, blockbuster revelation. But is it a surprise? No. The achievement that he has done is to be able to nail it all down. And in particular, in my mind, to attach it to Hong Kong money, which suggests overseas connections for the money as well.
So I suppose the reason for this is that China's essentially capitalist economy, which is booming, is regulated by a communist party. And so many of these wealthy and powerful state enterprises are state-controlled enterprises. So the party officials can basically put their fist in the till and nobody knows any the better, right?
Yes, this is what the New York Times columnist a number of years ago dubbed market Leninism. It's not freewheeling raw capitalism entirely. It is that. But at the core, the hugest companies are controlled by people that are connected to the top. Now, there is a very strong tradition in Chinese culture that goes back centuries against public corruption by officials. So that means that when this is done, it has to be done under ruses and guises and hidden. Right when the reforms began in the 1980s, the typical pattern was that the people with political power would move into a state enterprise, a factory or a mine or something, and use their political power to get the resources they needed in order to set up private companies. And they would skim off the profitable parts of these enterprises, and then if something went wrong with the rest of it, just let it go and continue to be a public enterprise. But later, by now, I think the more common pattern is just old-fashioned graft that, again, is not done explicitly. Wen Jiabao issued a statement yesterday, also reported in today's New York Times, that he himself has not been involved in all of these companies. And in a technical sense, I bet that's right. What happens is that everyone knows that he's the one that can pull certain levers to make certain things be possible or not, permits and access to resources and so on. And his family members, in his stead, show up and say, wouldn't you like to cooperate with me, and here's the price, and I'll be on your board, and so on. And so the pattern that Barbosa has revealed is to show how all the family members on both sides, in-laws and blood-related, have done this and profited immensely.
Again, I'm speaking with Perry Leek, expert on China, who in the 1990s edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by high-level Chinese officials that helped chronicle the events that led up to the pro-reform student protests in 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Leek. Now, clearly the Chinese government have cracked down on media dissemination of this story. They've blocked the New York Times website and the Wen Jiabao. Bao's family have rejected the New York Times, not surprisingly, article. But of course, this flies in the face of what Mr. Wen has, as Chinese premier, has crafted this image of himself over the last 10 years as having the common touch with a leader who has great concerns for the lives of ordinary people. Are the ordinary people in China likely to find out about this?
I think that, well, the ordinary people, meaning workers and farmers and so on, probably not, and it'll probably take a long time if they do. The ones that are net savvy and know how to use VPNs to jump the great firewall, as we call it, and get outside of the Chinese internet that's censored will know about it, and already do know about it. And in those circles, the news is spreading quickly. But will it seep down to the ordinary people? No. You're quite right, though, to point out that it's especially ironic that Wen Jiabao's family is found to be so moneyed, because he is the one who's been the regime's symbol for the last 10 years for crocodile tears. Anytime there's a blizzard or a flood or an earthquake, he's the one who rushes to the scene and beats his chest and says, I feel your pain, and so on. And the ordinary people, they buy this in general. So that if his story gets out, it will be doubly subversive of the regime's pretense that it doesn't engage in this kind of thing. In other words, if he is this dirty with money, then everybody else must be, will be what ordinary people conclude.
So, Perry Link, I understand that what's going on behind the scenes is a succession struggle in this normally bland transition, which is not happening this time, that the Communist Party Politburo is deadlocked with intra-party wrangling over power, privilege and profit. And it seems to have started with the Bo Xilai case. Give us a sense of the factions here, because clearly, a lot of stuff is being leaked here by people who are involved in this internal power struggle.
Yes, you're really on the ball, Ian. You do your homework. The speculations about why these reports have been leaked, but first I must say, in fairness to David Barbosa, he has defended himself against the charge that he's only used leaks and shown how he's done his research independently for more than a year. He has immense integrity. I believe him. But the larger picture, that yes, there is a political struggle. One of the standard ways to try to discredit your rival in these political struggles is to accuse them of corruption, because as I mentioned a moment ago, there's a long, strong tradition in China against official corruption. Another favorite is sexual dalliance, and Bo Xilai, among other things, was accused of that. It is not impossible to say, though, at least for me, exactly who is doing what to whom. This goes on inside a black box. We can, of course, discern the main factions. There's the Shanghai group that's around the former president, Jiang Zemin, and that is somewhat at odds with the Hu Jintao group. The new leader coming in, if he does make it, and it looks like he will, the new leader, Xi Jinping, is in the Shanghai group. So there is a shift there of the tectonic plates, and there's a lot of back and forthing. Bo Xilai, of course, played his cards wrong and now is completely discredited and will be lucky if he doesn't get a long prison term. But exactly, who is helping which journalists to get access to what stuff is hard to pinpoint. I can't do it. But that it's happening and that it reflects a struggle at the top, I think, is beyond question.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Perry Link.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Perry Link, who holds a chancellorial chair for innovative teaching across disciplines and is also a professor of comparative literature and foreign languages at the University of California, Riverside. He's one of the world's foremost experts on Chinese language, culture, and people. He's translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English, and in the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protests in June of 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.